Now, when, the time you, pardon me.
I don't believe you have your mic.
That's right. That's right.
You first came to Iran in 71, I guess, Douglas MacArthur the second.
Yes,
ambassador.
That's right.
Then. How closely did you work with him?
He was a very interesting individual to work with, in that he was very dynamic, he was very positive, he was very self-assured, he was just a completely self-reliant individual, and a very senior individual in his people. But he literally didn't feel beholden to anyone. So he worked in such a way that he had one of the traits of the General Douglas MacArthur, and he was sort of on stage and he was presenting himself and he was Mr. Big, but he wasn't jealous at all of how information was gathered or who accomplished something. He didn't seem too concerned about who got credit for what getting done. He wanted the job done. He was a delightful man to work with. You asked how closely I worked with him. When I first went over, he had me and my wife over for lunch with him tomorrow. And we learned each other reasonably well. And then I would say I was personally with him at least once a week, maybe twice. And he was a good man to work with. He was not hesitant, he was not bashful at all. He knew exactly where you stood with him. He spoke right out. He said exactly what he thought. He invited me to do the same. And, I was in a field somewhat different from many of his activities, and so he respected my opinion. He was a delightful person.
Could you get an opinion on how effective you think he was as ambassador? Did you get a sense of how effective he was?
I have to go right back to one of my previous comments. Mm-hmm. The Iranians respected the Americans to a fault. They never would have criticized it. I don't think they wouldn't have thought about that as being anything other than very effective. From my standpoint, he did a very good job. And I never heard any criticism at all, except for a few, what you call lazy people that felt like you pushed them pretty hard. But that's a compliment rather than criticism.
You mentioned earlier that to some extent, Iranians trusted North American military people more than they did people from the embassy in general.
Maybe trust is an overstatement. They were more comfortable working with me. I think they trusted us. They didn't have to trust us. But they really felt that the military man was completely out of it. His rank was exposed, his position was known, and they just felt like everything was on top of the table. And the Iranians, their own culture set up. In other words, over there, even in their country, they would not give a civilian a top secret clearance. No civilians.
Only military people.
None had top secret clearance. Now, the Shah would bring some of his prime minister, for instance, into his confidence and tell him things about that. But as far as the official lineage is concerned, nobody outside the military.
Now, the next ambassador was Joseph Parliament.
Yes.
And you worked with him fairly closely as well?
Very close. He was a completely different type of individual, although that was the fourth country he had been ambassador to. Not what you call a career professional ambassador. He was a a wealthy man, he was successful, influential. He didn't have the years of background experience that gave him near the confidence that Douglas MacArthur had. So if I had any criticism of Bill Fallon, I still consider him as a personal friend. We still communicate. We live back and forth. We live over one day. He's a personal friend and a nice guy. My own criticism, if I had to give him, would be he didn't have the self-confidence that he should have had. He was somewhat broken. For instance, when I went to the college to talk to the chef, I think I might have my shortest visit the whole time over there was an hour and 45 minutes. I was habitually at 2 hours, 12, 15 minutes. I had finished my military discussion in about 20 minutes. And then the Shah used me as just a philosopher, bounce for it. As he said, the Shah told me, I'm pleasing you all my children. He said, I was certainly I'm glad I have you. He said, in my high government, I can't get my subjects to disagree with me. He says, I often have a difficult time finding out what they think because they're trying to tell me what they think I want to hear. And he says, you are open and above board, and if you think I'm wrong, you let me know. And he says, that's priceless. And he used me that way. Not that I was any smarter or any nicer or any more capable than other people, but I was one that was there with the book wide open. No bone to pick. And I could be honest with you. I could ask him, I said, no, have you really thought this through? I was smart enough that I knew he was telling me I think he thought he was a damn fool. And I never did anything that brash. But quite frequently I said, now, are you sure you consider me? Or how about something? Would that end up in the final analysis what you want? And so we would go back and forth just almost ad nauseam, and he'd bring up this subject and that subject, and then after each audience, as it was called, I would send back a message to the state and with what was called an audience report. I would say, Sean discussed this, but a lot of it was intelligence stuff, a lot of it was military stuff. But 80% of it was not in my field at all. And it used to drive the top floor of the State Department building crazy. What made General Wilson discuss with Mr. Shaw? I must have gone back country 20 times saying, look, I didn't bring up this subject. I was about to board. I just listened. And then placate them for a few weeks, and all of a sudden send me a note. Why did you discuss agriculture down there? I said, I didn't discuss it. He did. But he used me to solve a problem now to get back to it. And that's the fall. It just irritated me to death that the Shah was talking to me about that. He wouldn't talk to me about that. But again, we're back where we were an hour ago. The Shah was helping me and bounce back and forth and just sort of philosophize. If he talked with the ambassador, as I said, that's the equivalent of talking with the top man in our sovereign government, and it was a government to government, not an open question discussion. And that used to embarrass Ambassador Fox. It used to bother him very much.
Now, former CIA Director Richard Helms followed Ambassador Helms, Ambassador Farland as ambassador, which is early 73. What kind of a working relationship did you have with him?
A lot of this was completely outside of my purview. I had nothing to do with it. I was involved in running said, take Richard Dolan's name to the palace and get their approval. That's the way he learned that he was leaving. Just devastating to the man because he had been in the United States on official visit. Nobody mentioned to him. He came back from the States, got back to Iran, Tehran, in a very short time. Get this out there. Take the name. That's the way he learned what's going on. So, of course, he was hurt very much. He was rushed over there very quickly to arrive before President Nixon got there. So he moved out of Pakistan on a very, very short notice. To come over and just leap off the state. Well, I don't know whether they, I don't know whether they were dissatisfied with the way he was doing his job, or whether Richard Helms was leading the CIA and they had to have a spot for him to talk to philosophizing on that point. And I don't have any information at all to bring the light to that subject. But, Dolan left in a hurry, sort of under a cloud. Holmes came in as the former CIA director, and everybody was wondering, what the hell is this all about? Well, personality-wise, Richard Hamilton was sort of a cold fish. He looks at you, but he's not focused on the eyes, he's looking just over your shoulder. And you don't really know whether he's agreeing with you or not. And so, from a personality standpoint, something is just curious. A lot of the people that were pretty well out of sorts.
Yeah, in the embassy or on the Iranians? On the Iranians?
If the Iranians and their administration at all, I would not have heard of them. So, no, I didn't get the slightest indication of anything wrong there. The only real problem I had, Mr. Burke, the only questionable thing I had at all with Dick Young was he wanted to put one of his agents on my staff. We've already discussed that. I just couldn't hear that. And he just insisted on putting him on the side. My instructions were very explicit. And unless I got instructions from the United States to tell a man what I had, I could not accept one of these people on my staff and let him work in the intelligence field. Just what? So he decided, all right, he's got this man coming on over anyway, so he put him over on, put him somewhere outside of my meeting. And then, to make matters worse, the one of the top men in the Iranian government came to me and said, we understand so-and-so is in country and we don't want
him. The CIA person.
Mm-hmm. Said, we don't want him in this country. He said, but we certainly do not want to declare him to Solomon God. So can you do something to get rid of? So I went to speak out the military very much because somehow or other I always had a feeling that he thought I'd put him up there. I did nothing about him, made this request of me, and I told him that the man was not one of my people, and we're discussing with you at this point on this bill. So they stopped the man in the government, told him not to go down. And they counted already decided that he was going to come in the country and he was going to come to the country. He did around for several weeks. I learned all of a sudden that the man had arrived. hundred and something. And I figured it wasn't my business. It wasn't assigned to me. The man was there about 10 days and all of a sudden he was gone. So whether the airline went to the back or not, that's the only problem of any kind that I have with the accountants. The accountants came in about the time that I had my physical problem. He seemed to have gotten along. Margaret, this is Dr. William Burr.
Yeah,
this is my wife, Margaret.
I'm here. The new magazine.
You may.
You all have a chair between you for a reason?
Oh. Well, we put it there for a reason, and then the reason got overcome, and we didn't move the chair.
Can I get you anything? Darling? Okay.
Doing fine. I don't know why this chair is better. That might have been
done. Besides the various ambassadors that we talked about, did you work with any other embassy officials fairly closely from time to time? Did any names stand out in particular among the embassy staff at that time?
Only periodically. Passing, not enough to pass the judgment.
Yeah.
I do want to make one observation. In the 50s, when I was working with the military assistance program, and we've already talked about the fact that these programs were controlled in varying degrees from the Washington area, and as the guidance information back and forth between the Washington City and the individual countries, the ambassador and his role vary quite a bit. President Eisenhower stepped in and formalized what had been allegedly going on all along, what they call the country team. And he let it be known that the ambassador was the number one U.S. representative in each and every country. Now that may sound simple on the surface, but as you go to countries at that time, like Vietnam, Taiwan, Korea, Greece, Turkey, there were a good many countries where the military element overshadowed everything else. So the U.S. military top man was a pacing factor in many, many activities to such an extent that in some of them, at least, the ambassador was relegated to a back seat. And in some other countries where there was even a closed contest, the contest got the job. In particular, it's true in Thailand and in Vietnam. There were times when the ambassador and the military members just kept each other close. I know when I put a bug in the other's office and things of that sort. So the country team was the thing that was formulated the evolution. Eisenhower said, no more victims, the ambassador is the lead man. And we'll always be letting them understand. From my background, when I arrived, I knew that each time when I arrived, I should say, and then each time we got the ambassador, I went to the party and said, I understand this. You don't have it with me. I don't have the grit of personality with the rest of you. And so I said, I accept you as the individual representative of the president of our country. Not one of our countries. Our military people didn't understand, but didn't want to understand. We have not, to the best of my knowledge, there was never a real knockdown to write out argument between our ambassador and our military in Iran. Certainly not while I was there, because I always went and cleared the air before it got out. But that was not true. So I didn't know Vietnam, and I went over in 1960. And it was just, couldn't tell each other about you something bad. Vitriolic debate. Just mean at each other. Not only didn't like each other, didn't trust each other. Each thought the other was crazy. So that's something that developed as time went on. And it didn't develop about a fair amount of skin notes.
So there weren't those kinds of problems that were approached at in Iran.
We did not have that in Iran. I think I had a lot to do with ensuring this didn't come up. But there's also another individual there in the ministry, the deputy chief of mission, and Mr. Douglas Peck, H-E-C-K. Doug Heck was a very low-key, smooth, level-headed individual. He just didn't, they used to call him unflappable Doug. And he didn't let things fall up and explode. And I was doing so anyway back then. A little misunderstanding started developing. We got it cleared up. So we didn't have the flare-ups of some of the other things.
When you were chief of the military mission, did you receive like CIA reports on conditions in the country? Did you receive intelligence reports from military people or CIA people?
The CIA as such, no. I don't believe I got any what you call official CIA reports. I very frequently got information from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the State Department, or one of the individual military departments. We have concern about this. We have observed this. This finding from our end valid from your observations, so forth, something like that. CIA, I don't recall ever seeing that. Written about.
Did you be with the station chief from time to time, or did you
have different? We were on a very friendly basis. He was always present when the last night meeting. He was basically present with a group. Not basically, often present on social events. He was supposedly on the cover of the book. Not recognized having any rank. He was a civilian, a so-called working level, so he often at the certain formal affairs sat way down below the salt, as we called him, things of that sort, but he was operating. But he never placed a requirement on me. I don't recall if he's ever telling me anything. I got my information to the ambassador.
Now, did any other countries have military missions in Iran? Did the British have a mission? A military mission?
No. Our bilateral agreement excluded all other countries. that thing pretty sticky. As time went on, the Russians were extremely interested in getting a foothold. The Russians offered the Iranians military equipment at way, way less than cost. In other words, they offered helicopters. They went on to take, I'd say, 1/10 of what it would cost us to go. They were just very, very anxious to get a foot in the military side. The Shah did buy Russian trucks. He bought some Russian engineer equipment. He bought some Russian artillery. He bought some Russian armored personnel carriers. But he had as a very hard, he had two very hard passwords. One, he would never buy anything that was so complicated that the Russians had to send advisors with. The Russians even offered to take his students to schools in Russia, send them to the schools free, and pay them a living stipend while they were there and return it back. He would not buy anything from the Russians that they had to be involved in the operation of the island. One other point, he would not buy anything from the Russians that they had to have people spread out in this country. In other words, they built him, I mean, the steel mill, they built him several bridges, but he would not let them work on communications lines or anything that they had spread out. If they could come in and build a bridge and be physically tied to that geographical location, he would accept it. But he would not let them spread out in this country. He didn't trust the Russians.
Now you mentioned in our last interview that you did a lot of traveling around the country.
I tried to go to a different location twice a week. I had my own airplanes. I flew myself. I had complete control. No one could question where I was going or why I was going. I was completely liberty from where I wanted to talk with anybody in the country.
How to, how would you characterize, since you saw a lot of the country during this period, how would you sort of characterize social and economic conditions that you saw?
Well, in my travels, my interest was military. So I would always make my initial contacts with the military people. But as I went, I habitually took with me one aide, either my Iranian aide or my American aide. I very often took my wife and took one of my staff officers with his wife. We turned the ladies loose to look around. They call it shopping with friends and clients. They spent much money when they visited the school, the hospitals, craft shops. And the Iranians just love that business. So we would always send them a message one day saying to come in tomorrow. And they would have someone to meet me, and my staff officer and my aide would take off looking at military things, and somebody would be there. My wife and the other lady would take off with sometimes a man, sometimes a woman, sometimes several people. And they would go and would say, meet back, so and so forth. As a rule, we went into these places and stayed overnight. We'd go in, arrive around noon, leave early the next morning. So we had an airplane that had the special landing gears and the personal props, so we could land on just about anything we wanted to. Nothing to road. Didn't have to be an air vehicle. So we went into real big places, real little byways, what have you. And we always asked the ladies there in person what they saw in the civilian side. And sometime we found time to flip around on the civilian side. For instance, we went to Mesquite, and that's way up in the northeastern part of the country, right on the Russian border. We were told that an American Peace Corps volunteer had drawn up the plans and had engineered the construction of a beautiful, beautiful garden area, botanical garden park. And I said, gosh, that's interesting. I'd love to see it. And I said, fine, we can go. How about 5 o'clock? Fine. So I asked, I said, can you contact the ladies? I'm sure they'd like to go see. So we arranged at 5 o'clock, we arrived at this park. Turned out to be, I guess, 20, 25, 30 acres, maybe, pretty good sized park. All kinds of little trails and ponds and little bridges. And the guy had really looked like he was designing a golf course, but the interesting part of it, two interesting things happened. When we got there, much to my embarrassment, I looked around and saw that there were no people at all anywhere. And much to my embarrassment, when I asked where the people were, oh, they had cleared the park so my wife and I could go to walk in private. So they run hundreds of people away just to let us go to walk. So I said, this is embarrassing. Open the park, let the people back in. So they did. But then as we were walking around, all of a sudden I heard this voice come out over the horizon, beautiful voice. And I said, that mule, of course, really caring. The lady in the mule always calls for people to pray, and he goes up and down that, and you know, I take her system. We went on a little bit. Got, when I made the remark about the mule voice being so beautiful, I think that might be it. We went on, we walked a little more, and put his singing voice, and I just stopped. That's the most melodious voice I've heard. That must be a very popular mooer. No, sir. That's not a mooer. That's a man advertising a belly dancer show tonight. So, you're running the crazy thing. But we did contact, talk with the working level. Peasant type, the lower level class, quite frequently. And in that way, we got an insight that a lot of people didn't have. There was one time, I was at a Mesquite Solomon one time, with all of my, we put in a fantastically large tank rebuild factory. And we were rebuilding the World War II tanks. I had a workforce of about 800 people. And I was walking around talking with the community, the workmen, and what have you. Usually, at the working level, you have to use an interpreter. And I stopped there, the one man was working on the electronic circuit. I asked him if he felt like he understood his job, and of course, answered obviously yes. I asked him if it was a, if he felt as though it was a good job. I said, "Is this a worthwhile job, one that you can do fine?" He says, "It has to be a worthwhile job. I've got 6 miles to feed." I thought that was interesting beyond my pay rate, I would expect. A few days later, I was at the palace talking to Shaw, and I said, "Well, ran across an interesting thing." And I said, "Man, Diamond came out and told me that he had a good job, and he had to have a good job because he had 6 miles to feed." I said, "Oh, oh, oh," and we tried so hard on birth control, the population kept going too fast. And I said, "No, this wasn't a birth control breakdown. As soon as he got a good job, two uncles and two aunts moved in with him." But on the birth control deal, show you how they think that. They instituted it. Very ambitious program. Try to help the lowest level of the economy. You've got to realize that over there, in 1960, when the so-called white revolution started, there was about 5% of the people that were educated, were wealthy, and were in control. And all the rest of the people were literally peasants. They were just uneducated, unwise. So they were working real hard to develop the middle class. And Shaw mentioned that time and time again. He said it's one of the dangerous things that a dictator or a king can do is to develop a middle class and invite them to participate in what he called nation building. He said, "But I'm going to do it. And they are going to participate in the running of this country." I have to do it, because at present, I have the power. I have the control. He never dreamed that he would be overthrown. But he did state very frankly to me that one of his successors probably would be overthrown if he developed the middle class faster than they could have sought it. You know, this old deal, rising expectations. That's the thing you have to control. He said, when you get someone that has never had anything at all, you give him a loaf of bread, he's like, "A loaf of bread." And by the time you give him 10 loaves of bread, he's wondering why he didn't have 20. And so you have to control the development of this middle class. So he started birth control as part of his helping to keep the lowest level of growing in numbers faster than the middle class could be developed. He started a series of television shows. It fell absolutely flat. The peasants just didn't want to understand. They had American advisors in it, everybody was brother over there trying to make the program go into just like getting the first place. Finally, someone realized that this is a religious thing. The people just, so the way they fixed it, and it corrected just like that, they took the man that was a woman that was explaining the birth control approach. And right beside him or her, they had a mullah. Mullah didn't say a word except at the beginning he would say, "My advice is that you listen. You listen and you understand." He never spoke again. The program caught fire and went well. I don't know how we got on that. But okay.
We're talking about social conditions in the country.
Yeah.
in Iran during this period, how basically stable do you think the political situation was? Are there any signs of instability, political instability, or concerns about political instability at this time?
When I first arrived over there, I would have said absolutely solid. I would have said no question. They had their big October 1971 2,500 year anniversary celebration, which I've described as a debutante ball. So Shah said, we are coming out and we are accepting our rightful place among the developed nations. He had this kingdom during that 4-5-8 period. The very top individual, or the personal representative of the top individual, Mao Gandhi, sent black president. But he had the top level representative from 6 to 9 different countries. I think my wife described it one time. She said, look at that. There are those people there carrying on idle conversation, friendly conversation. And under the circumstances, they've separated so much they wouldn't be caught within feet 29 range of each other. You see the Haile Selassie from Ethiopia sitting there talking to him, and he told he was the idea of Queen of England and stuff like that. And the king of Greece, Turkey, Greece and Turkey had their top people. So they had these top people there, and they had a little village that was built just for them. Each one of these country representatives had a separate little cottage that had been built. They called them tents. They were cottages with tents on top of them. Only the roof was a tent. Underneath was a little two-bedroom, nice little cottage that they ran to turn into a tourist motel after it was open. I'm not sure what happened. But anyway, those people lived in that village down in Shiraz. They associated back and forth. I drove in the convoy and buses coming back and forth through the airport in Shiraz and flying up to Tehran, what have you. There were no military units brought in. Each of the little villages was controlled. It's your responsibility to maintain order. We drove. Just unbelievable. We would drive, I'd call it 20, 30 miles in among all these little villages, and the people were out there waving and all that. And if there was any dissonant element, it certainly did not find us. Now, in for seconds, where they had the big parade, the major participants.